Okay, maybe we should start. I'll just close the door. Some practical things first. If you look at the Fronter page now, you will see in the resources folder that I have put some examples of exam questions there. There will probably be a few more by the exam, but I think there are some 20, 30 questions there now. For this week's assignment, let's just go through these. A lot of you have delivered already. You have a few hours to redo it if you feel like that. This can be done complicated, or it can be quite simple and straightforward. I know that a lot of people are trying to overanalyze this and then overachieve a little bit on the analysis part here. But as I said, it can be pretty simple for the Kansas paper. The basic, I think, independent variable should be whether you measure a Kansas or a pancake, because that's what you put into the equation here. And you want to see whether the flatness is depending on that variable. And flatness is then, or flatness as operationalized by the formula for measuring flatness, is then the dependent variable. So, should be pretty straightforward. Of course, you can, there are other issues, like reliability and validity here that may be discussed. Have anyone got any ideas on that? Is this a reliable study? Yes, somebody says. Why is it reliable? Yeah, every time you do the same calculation, you will probably get the same answer, right? And every time you measure the same, at least if you measure the same pancake. You're right, because there are issues here. Would you get the same result if you measure different pancakes? Maybe you would get the same answer. I'm not sure, but at least that's something that should be addressed, yes. No, but based on the way they measure it here, it would still probably be less flat than Kansas. So, not the same result, but still you would probably have pretty good reliability, I would say. And the instruments are reliable here, right? The material that you measure is maybe not so reliable, right? Because they're not stable. Kansas is, but if you took another slice through Texas, it would be different. Yeah, but still, if you measure things in the scale, if you compare micrometers to meters, as they do here, any pancake would be less flat than any measurement you would take here of Kansas, probably. I'm not sure. But is it valid then? Of course, that is a much bigger question. No, I would say no. It's not valid. By any terminology or the way we use the term flat, it has to do with our observation. So Kansas isn't as flat as a pancake. So it would probably be the other way around, because we're measuring something quite different here on these two variables. So, but this isn't written in stone, so you may discuss these things. You may also get to more complex answers than this. But this is the straightforward way to look at independent and dependent variables. The important thing to remember here, and the error that some does, is that when we talk about independent variables, we tend to think it shouldn't depend on anything. Well, it can depend on a lot of things. But the important thing is that this is what you choose to see whether something else is depending on. So it's not that it's independent of the world or everything else. It's just that you have, this is what you put into the equation as the one you want to measure the effect of. The other one, laptop use. There's also a very straightforward thing that the independent variable, the main focus here is, of course, users or non-users of computers during class. That's what we're looking at. But you could also say that it could be turned around and say that something like noise levels or something like that is the independent variable here. What is discovered as noise? So you could say that academic, non-academic use actually was an independent variable, but the straightforward thing is users, non-users here. And the dependent variable is then either, I would say, attitudes towards academic and non-academic use. And then you have some control variables, for instance, reasons for not using computers and stuff like that, which is more like control variables here. Because we want to check whether that actually affects the outcome here. Why didn't people use computers? Well, it wasn't because they didn't have access to it, it was because they didn't want to use them. Reliability, validity. I'm biased here because I wrote this, so I would say it's still both reliable and valid, of course. But you may argue against that. That's up to you. I think we would get pretty much the same results if we redid this. I don't think things has changed so much. What has changed, of course, is the devices we use and stuff like that. But I think the general picture is quite similar to this. Operationalization of variables here. Have we been good enough there? That you may be right there, yeah. Remember, this is a short paper written very in a very, I don't know, quick and dirty manner. So I don't think we were very good at those things. So there are terminologies here that we didn't specify and define well enough. Yes? I think what we should have been very careful, what we, I don't know if we've been that careful, but the important terms are the terms that we say something about in the main research question. And I think the question we ask is whether computers are, or computer usage are considered as distractions during lectures. And of course, distractions there. What do we mean by noise, or what do we mean by, as you said, what do we actually mean by being distracted is maybe the important things here. And maybe we weren't that good at defining these things. The first paper, I think, were they good at operationalizing these variables? Yeah, I think so. They were pretty precise. Probably. So they wrote about something not very serious, but did it in a very formalized, good way. While we, I think, were addressing an important topic, and we weren't that precise, okay? So, next, just a little step back, what we mean. I've been referring to data, and this is maybe somewhat a sum up of things we have done so far. When we refer to data, we don't refer to the actual whole truth about anything. We are looking at manifestations of that truth, of the reality that we are looking at. So any data analysis, any interpretation of data means that you have to apply theories, you have to try to explain what you observe, and you have to analyze possibilities that you are deviating from the actual whole truth. And there is always, almost at least always, so that there are possibilities to go deeper into a topic, or even go a step back on a topic. Just imagine something hard data, like the results they get from a particle accelerator, like the CERN things, this Large Hadron Collider thing, where they are looking at, they're putting enormous amounts of energy into particles that they crash, and then they observe some particles that are the results of that crash. When they do this, they tend to say that, oh, well, now we have split things into the least possible particles. At least that's what they said some 10, 20 years ago. But what is shown to be the case is that the more energy they put into these things, the more the more particles you seem to get out of it. So there is always also, when it comes to hard data, possibilities to go a lot further in your analysis, and this goes also for most software questions. You need to if you read an article and see that they have gotten to some kind of an answer, there is probably ways to continue or to go deeper into that, to take nuances based on their findings and discuss that further. For the third point there, when we analyze data or when we observe data, right, a lot of these data tend to be secondary data, and especially when we are asking people about things, we are dealing with what we can call secondary data. It's people's impressions of things. It's how people remember things, how they observe things, that comes out as that is what we observe, not the real case. And humans, especially as observers, are kind of unreliable as observers. And one such example is, for instance, what we can call eyewitness testimonies. Or a lot of studies has been done on this. This refers to a study by Loftus and Palmer, which is quite famous. They did this in the early 70s, 74, I think. Where they were investigating how reliable are a witness when you ask him afterwards what he experienced. And what they did was that They made a pretty smart kind of experiment where they gave different instructions to several groups of participants. They gave the same stimuli material, which was a film where they saw one car bumping into or crashing into, that's the important thing here, another car. It was the same film they saw. A car stops in front of some light, what is it called? Light, stop light. And then another car crashes into it. And result is a small, a little bit of damage, I think. But what they vary here is that during this quest, or during the instructions, they vary the question a little bit. For instance, the first group here gets this instruction. You're now going to watch a movie where you will see a car contacting another car. The next group hears hits another car. The next group again hears bumps into, and then collides, and then smashes. So you can see that you vary the degree of that verb, I guess it is. And the result here is quite amazing, because when you afterwards ask these people, they weren't prepared for this, but when you ask them afterwards, how fast do you think the car were, or how fast did it drive, the car that bumped into the other one? And there is actually a linear relationship here between the mean values mentioned by these observers, based on the small change in this one word. So the group that hears contacted says, well, 30 miles an hour, while the other group says 40, or the most extreme group says 40. So we're not very good observers. And to add to this, when people were asked about other things they saw, how much debris did you see, how much damage did you see, on a scale of from 1 to 10, how much damaged was the rear end of the first car? There is actually a linear relationship there as well. So the harder the verb is, the tougher, or the more damage was caused in the collision here. So we're not good observers of the world. We are in a context when we observe something, and maybe you need also to analyze this context to be able to give a good answer, or to understand the real truth, or what's behind the observed data you have here. There are, of course, a number of other things can just illustrate this, that we observe things based on context. So the important thing here is, for instance, to look at this thing here, the number here, or the letters, maybe. So whether you read it in this context, of course, is very different from reading it in this context. When you look at something like this, can you see two things there? One thing or two things? Two? Depends on the way you read it. If you read it one way, you can see something like a rabbit or a hare or something like that. It runs with his ears behind him in the wind. The other way, it's a seagull. So things are ambiguous in our world. The C here can be a nose, it can be a letter, it can be a number, the B here. So context is important for us, right? We are not good observers of the world. So be careful when you try to conclude based just on people's observations and impressions of the world. It's secondary data. Some other terminologies that's important when it comes to data is that data can be of a number of in a number of different categories. And this is important when we are gathering data, because if we gather data on, let's say, the wrong category, it limits us quite a lot when it comes to data analysis. But the other way around, if you go too far down this ladder and try to operate or try to measure something that really shouldn't be measured on such a detailed scale, well, you can do mistakes the other way around. You can say here that we categorize data in, well, there are different ways of doing this. It you can usually see three or four categories. The first one is what we call nominal data. Data that can't be ranked. It's just names we put on something. Gender is the typical example of this. You can't say that one is better than the other. So you can't actually say that what you code as number two here is better than number one. Because when you do this in a spreadsheet, you tend to code it into numbers anyway. But still, it doesn't mean that a higher number is better or something like that. At least you should argue hard to do that when it comes to gender and stuff like that. It's not politically correct to do it. The next level is what we can call ordinal data, where you could say that, say things like educational level. Going to a high school is more than going to just basic education. Taking a 2 years university course is more than, or a bachelor's degree is more than just high school or college. Taking a master's degree is again more, but it's hard to, well, it's ranked data. One is more than the other, but you can't say that the steps between these, the levels of this rank is linear or something like that, but one is more than the other. And this also goes for a lot of responses in questionnaires. If you are to rank things, or if you are to say that on a scale from 1 to 3, how much little something, a lot, you can't say that the step from nothing to a little is smaller than, is the same as from little to much or something like that in the scale. And then you have ordinal data, which is, it's ranked, but there are some limits. You can't. It's not necessarily so that you can use mean scores and stuff like that when you compare variables that's on a level like this. Question. Yeah. How much? That's something you could say that's something in between an ordinal scale, and this is typically what you find in a Likert scale. You get some kind of an expression, and you could say how much do you agree with this expression. I enjoy seafood, something like that. And then you have a mean value, and then you have two lower values and two higher values. And usually you tend to, at least when you combine several of these scores, you tend to treat them like scale variables. But it's, to be strict, one such question is just it's just an ordinal question. But combined, we tend to apply the same type of statistics as we do on scaled things. Because that is then the next one. Scales where you, well, it can be interval scales, but it can also be ratio scales, which is even more strict, where you actually know there is a zero, and you know there is an absolute negative value and an absolute positive value. The number of errors performed during a test or something like that is typically such a measurement. Height, age, temperature, stuff like that. And you can the general thing is that the higher you are up on this scale, or the more you are towards the scale data, the more type of statistical procedures can be applied. So, in general, if you are to compare something in a quantitative way, it's maybe a good idea to try to at least get some data that's high on this list. You can do statistics with nominal data as well, as we'll probably get back to. You can do things as something like chi-squares, stuff like that. You can just look at how things are distributed in a table, a 4x4 table, for instance, and see whether that deviates from what's expected if things were random, for instance. So it's a way to handle this. Now, let's move over to one of the central topics today, measuring things, describing things in the world around us. And something that I'm quite sure that a lot of you will do at some point in a master's project, in other projects, is that you will try to measure the state of affairs of some kind of question. How are things out there today? What do people think about stuff today? How do they react to things? It's not observations, but it's what we call surveys. There are a number of ways to perform surveys. It's not just interviews, of course. In its traditional form, a survey was performed by someone who were interviewing you, who spoke to you face to face. But it can be telephone interviews, mails, or mail links to questionnaires. And today, everybody seems to do variations of that, namely using the net to gather data for questionnaires. Using electronic surveys is, as I said, used by everyone, but it has some sides to it that we will get to here, that also tells you that this is something you should be a little bit careful when you do. Of course, there are a lot of advantages when you do electronic surveys, and the most obvious one has to do with cost. Compared to interviewing everyone, well, this is a very cheap way to get a lot of respondents. And you get it fast. You could also reach quite a wide audience. We'll get to some limitations there, of course. And you get the data in a, you could say, in a format which allows you to analyze it right away. Everything is numbers already when it's done electronically, so you don't have to score anything. It's very straightforward. You could say that there are a few problems as well that has partly to do with privacy and ethics. There are, you could think that doing things electronically adds anonymity, but it's rather the other way around, because responses given through electronic media tends to be trackable more than we would like to think, and people are becoming quite aware of these things now. If you, for instance, if you do, and this is somewhat tricky, if you use tools like, I think, SurveyMonkey, QuestBack especially, the default thing these tools do, these are web-based tools to do to help you doing surveys. What they tend to do is that for security reasons they track IP addresses, for instance, so that you can't do multiple responses to the questionnaire, so they use this as some kind of a control. But they also log this, so alongside all responses you can get this IP address, and this is the default setting. So it's somewhat problematic, because I've tried this a few times, and it's really amazing that you can track individuals back from this. So there are some issues there, and as we will get a little back to, it also has some, there are issues here when it comes to response rates. Maybe we can take that right away. In the good old days, when people were interviewed on the street, or when people were, when you were phoning people, not as they do today, if you get all these phones today as well, which is partly marketing, partly service. But in the old days, when that wasn't that common, you tend to get response rates on telephone interviews in the up in the 80-90% range. Most people you asked were willing to respond to your questionnaire. If you just do a general general request today on Facebook or something like that to the 1-2,000 of your nearest friends or something, what do you think the response rate would be? Any suggestions? What could you expect of a response rate, do you think, on such an open thing? No idea. 25%, that's extremely optimistic. If you get 5, you're lucky. Yeah, that's actually true. So the response rate you get today on these types of questionnaires is tend to be extremely low today, and of course we are a bit tired of them as well, because we see so many of them now, because it has become so easy to perform it. So and this is of course a huge problem, as we'll get a little back to, when it comes to representativity of these the responses that we get, because it's not necessarily so that the 5% or 10% we actually get are very representative of the whole population that we are going to, or that we are interested in. We'll get to the point of, or maybe we can just do this right away and just jump a little back here. Christopher, representativity is a really big issue when it comes to interpreting results from surveys or questionnaires that you put out. And a very famous example of this is a very old one, where this is from a poll done by an American magazine called Literary Digest. This was quite early in the could say the history of polls and how they did things. They predicted that during this election in 1936, a Republican called Landon would get 57% of the votes, while Theodore Roosevelt would get 43%. So an overwhelming majority towards the Republican voters here. Actually, when the election came up, the result was quite different. Roosevelt actually got 62% of the votes. So it was the other way around here, completely, even more than predicted in the first case. And this was quite a huge thing, much larger than anything we would do today. 2.4 million voters were asked or took part in this poll. So they asked actually 2.4 million voters what they would vote in this election. So what did go wrong here, do you think? We can continue a little bit and just tell you how they did things, because that may clarify it a little bit more. What they did was that they asked some 10 million voters to participate in 10 million potential voters to participate here. They got a positive response from 2.4 million of them, a response rate of 25%, much more, as I said, than what we get today. So this is, it's actually pretty good, a rate like this. The sampling method they used was that they were doing random picks or from phone registers here, and they were picking or inviting people from car owners registers, and they were picking people among their own readers. So they were inviting all their own readers to take part in the poll. And based on this invitation, they got 2.4 million people to answer the question. But the answer was completely wrong. Why? What went wrong here? Any ideas? Why weren't they representative for the rest of the population, you think? Yeah, something like that. So they were biased towards one of the candidates already. The richer you are, the more likely you are to vote Republican in the United States, right? Yeah. So the people that you invited to take part in this poll was probably middle class to upper middle class, something like that. While the distribution among the whole population here was quite different. We don't ask this many people today. A normal political poll today, you probably ask some, let's say, 400, 500, 600 people. And that's a huge poll, actually. That's quite a good one. And based on that, you can get pretty accurate measurements of how things are out there. What are people going to vote in the next? There are, of course, uncertainties that's under-communicated, let's say that, of some percent, but still. But what they do is that they know a bit more about the population, and they know whether their actual sample represents the population, and if it doesn't, they either do corrections based on how things actually are in the society. For instance, they correct this for gender, they correct it for age, they correct it for educational level. So every time you are invited to take part in a poll, they tend to ask some of these background questions that allows them to wait and analyze the questions in a proper way. And they know, for instance, that gender, income level, educational level, where you live in the country, stuff like that, may affect the results. And by balancing out these things, by doing a good selection based on these criteria, well, you get a much better estimate of your population. Let's just take this one first then. A lot of things are, of course, affecting whether we get a representative sample or not. And you could say that the more heterogeneous your the type of answers that you should expect on a questionnaire is, the more careful you need to be when you select your sample, and the larger the sample needs to be. So sample size will vary quite a lot here. How many people you need to ask to be able to generalize to a normal population depends quite a lot on the nature of the question that you're looking at. And we know that a few variables have impact on a lot of issues, and that is, as I said, gender, age, and these kinds of stuff. So it's usually a good idea when you do questionnaires to include these things, either for control or because you want to use it as actual independent variables. Sample sizes, there are some rules of the thumb to calculate it. And in general, if you are dealing with small populations, you should ask everybody. The response rate won't be 100% anyway. But there is no reason in doing or making a sample out of a small population. So the rule of the thumb here is, if this population is smaller than 100, just ask everybody. When you're reaching 500, and this is based on probabilities and statistical analysis, actually empirical data as well, when you get to 500, you usually tend to say that you should take half of them. When you reach 1,500, you're down to 20%. So the and when you when you're dealing with a huge population, if you're going to generalize to a huge population, well, a representative sample is, well, there is a roof here. So the limit seems to be, when you increase the number of respondents much about 400, you tend not to get very much improvements. So it's really not worth it to ask a lot more persons than this. So if you have a good sampling procedure, if you can make representative samples, 400 is enough. Okay, let's take a break and get out and get a shower or something. It's extremely wet out there. 15 minutes.